right, welcome back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. And my artist guest this week is Cindy Young from Luhu Stitches. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. Yeah, this is we met in the Nashville there, so, yep.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about that a little bit. This show brought to us by Fire Poppies, firepoppies.com. Check that all out, Susan Winter. Now, remember, she is a U.S. distributor for the Lowry Stands. So if you're looking for a stand and you're looking at the Lowry Stands, Susan at Fire Poppies is your place to go. She has the stands and the accessories. And then also the Coming to America project with Brenda Gervais, she has that. And then if you like really interesting and creative characters, whatever, check out Amy Brookin's 365 Days of Warm Woolly Welcomes. That's a fun piece, so that's worth checking out. And then, of course, the Sweet Land of Liberty re-release chart from Blackbird Designs, also available at Fire Poppies. And then if you want to participate in the Royal Garden Stitch Along that Vaughn and I are doing starting July 5, Susan has kits, threads, charts, so she can help you out with that and get you going so you're ready to go on July 5 to stitch that with us. And so firepoppies.com, or just call Susan and she'll fix you up. All right, Cindy, we met in the Nashville, got to see your work and said, all right, we got to talk more. So yes. You're one of those fun people who is pretty much a lifelong artist then.
I am probably since I could hold a crayon.
Yeah. Cause see, it's, you get designers, needlework designers who do needlework and then start designing and kind of have an art talent and then things just come together for them. And then we get artists who then end up doing needlework, which I think is an interesting way to go. When I hear artist, how do you get from artist to needleworker? And so you did artwork all through school?
Yeah, I mean, that was always my proclivity, was art. And my favorite part of any classroom day was if we got to do drawing or crafts or anything like that. And I always, I was always doing crafty things at home. I grew up, I'm a child of the 70s, so salt dough was a big deal.
Okay.
And, I can remember making little Christmas ornaments and painting them. And I think my mom pretty much bought me my own flour and salt so that I could make my own dough for a while.
Leave me alone. Make your own stuff.
Yeah. We need to eat. Stop using my flour. So always there were paints and crayons and anything not anything I wanted, but anything my mom could get for me, she would. I remember there being felt. I remember making felt ornaments with all the little doodads and shiny things on them. And, my whole life. And then, and I was always, I kind of grew up in the days of school where they routed you in certain directions. Right. So uh-huh. I was always kind of put with the artsy teacher that was always my favorite part of school was more than recess.
Did you continue art after high school?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I was always doing things on my own, but it wasn't what I originally, I went to college and that wasn't what I started. I was going to be a teacher, an English teacher.
There we go.
And
hey, former science teacher. It's all right.
Yeah, whatever. I was going to teach. I mean, and I wasn't aware of graphic design per se. Mm-hmm. Somehow I got through high school and nobody told me, well, this is how you can make money as an artist. Although not necessarily. But in college, yeah, I found out about graphic design.
So, someone will pay you for the work, but make money, right. It might be another level. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And so I went to California State University, Chico, and they have had a communications department, and under that umbrella had a graphic design program. Mm-hmm. And that's where I ended up. Loved every minute of that.
So then that would have been really before computerized design came along.
Right. I was right on the cusp of computer design. Literally, this would have been mid-80s. Mm-hmm. There was one computer design class, and it had 20 slots.
Yeah.
And I can't remember how many people were in the graphic design program, but I never got a slot. So fortunately, I got a internship with the Associated Student Body. Mm-hmm. And they had Macs.
Yeah.
The old Macintosh. Do you remember those? They're black and white screen.
Oh, yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
It was all the screen, the hard drive, and everything was one piece of equipment.
Yep.
And so I got to play around with that a little bit. And then, but all of my training was really old school. I took a marker rendering class.
Uh-huh.
I took a photography class. I took a lettering, how to create your own font type of class. I took typography, where you actually manipulate the letters by hand, and you know, and if you wanted type, you had to go to the typesetter to get the type, you know. So it was I missed out on computerized graphic design training probably by a year or two.
Yeah. Yeah, see, that was that period of time. See, was my early years in as a magazine editor,
right?
And so our magazine artists were working their way through that same process, making the transition from conventional print photos mm-hmm. a typeset and all of that to computerized things. And one of our artists had a side job, which I think he made a ton more money doing that than he did working for the magazine. But he worked for the magazine for the healthcare because he had kids. But he was an airbrush artist. And he had a gig doing the tabletops for Bally pinball machines. He would do those and all of that art.
Wow.
And so he would work during the day as a magazine artist. And then the next day he'd come in and he's just blurry eyed because he'd been up all night airbrushing Bally tabletops. Well, you know, it was worth it to make, you know, he was making a ton of money doing that. But then he started, he had to learn computerized graphic arts because that's where Bally was going. And so I remember that transition. So you were caught right in that same time period there. Yeah.
Right. And unfortunately, when I graduated from college, I was not able to get a design job before I got married.
Oh.
So I never got like kind of on the job training. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, probably within the first year that we were married, my husband works in resource management and, you know, natural resource management. He's a forester.
Oh, okay.
And we moved to a rural area. Well, there's not a call for graphic designers.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know. Yeah.
That cuts you right out of the picture. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, it was all for the good, but it was kind of like, oh, well, so much for that. Sort of, kind of.
Yeah. So, but you still, obviously you're a maker of things, so you still,
yes.
So must have kept that going in some way then.
Yeah. So we moved, to Northern California and into this rural environment. And, It was, now we're up to the early 90s when kind of the craft show thing was big and people were making, you know, making was more of a deal and people would go to a big craft show to see all the different handmade items. And I got sort of suckered into toll painting at that point. And basically my sister-in-law handed me a blank Dala horse that my father-in-law had carved. And she said, would you paint this for me? And I'm like, okay, I don't even know what a Dala horse is.
Yeah, so I don't either. What's a Dala? What is a Dala horse?
Have you gone to IKEA? Have you gone to IKEA?
Only and to get out of it.
The red wooden horses that have a traditional folk art painting on it are they're Swedish, sometimes called Swedish horses.
Okay.
Yeah. So my husband's family is Swedish. And anyway, so she handed this stuff to me and said, can you paint it for me? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. So lots of research ensued before the internet. And that's how I got kind of suckered into toll painting. And I found out I really liked it. And the local fabric store had some craft classes going on and there was someone teaching toll painting there. And so then that kind of morphed into a little craft business for a short time for a couple of years.
So you had the booth at the craft fairs, that routine?
Yes. Did that for a couple of years before we had kids. Oh. And pretty early on realized that this is not how you make money.
Yeah.
that the people making money, not that my whole creative world was about making money, but just that, you know, there was sort of like, you're trying to figure out how do I use this skill that I have to help support my family. And you know, my husband and I realized, well, we're breaking even on this, but
yeah,
you know, really what we're doing is supporting a hobby. We're not contributing toward our finances particularly.
Yeah. I've never seen how those craft fairs were profitable. All I could ever conclude was it was people who had a lot of idle time and then had more idle time on weekends to go sell what they made during their idle time during the week. Cause there just is no way if you figure out the per hour, money that it works. It just doesn't work.
No, because people aren't going to buy what it's really worth if you were to put an hourly cost on it. So my takeaway from that time was make patterns and let other people paint this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a baby, so.
Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah. Yeah, so then any kind of more career-minded making or crafting was put on hold.
Yep.
And it went into the hobby category.
Yeah.
So, but I was cross-stitching at this time also.
Oh, okay. So that's where the cross stitching comes in. Was you'd at least pick that up in that period there?
Yeah. So my mom was always into. I mean, I need to back up a little bit. So my mom, when I was talking about my childhood and crafting and making things, she was always doing stuff. I mean, she was learning, she was teaching herself to crochet. She was teaching herself to do crewel embroidery. She was teaching herself to sew. She sewed clothes for us. And, you know, she was always doing and making and figuring things out herself. And she was very drawn toward textiles.
Mm-hmm.
And so long about the mid 80s, when I was in graphic design school and too cool for school, she was getting into counter cross stitch. And she tried at that time to get me into counter cross stitch. And I'm like, no, that's like, you know, housewife stuff. And I'm a graphic designer.
I'm a much higher level than that. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Anyhow, but after I got married and we moved to this rural area, and I was a newlywed, new wife, I was suddenly interested in all the home arts and found this pattern in Better Homes and Gardens. And my mom was coming up for a visit, and I showed it to her. I said, I want to learn how to do this. I think she was probably over the moon. She was so excited. Finally, I can teach her how to do counter cross stitch. And so we went to I don't remember where we went and got our DMC, but we found DMC and some Aida cloth, and she got me all set up, and I was hooked from then on. So
she got you.
She got me finally. You know, and it was a barbed hook. It wasn't, a barbless hook. So.
That for any mother who does that kind of stuff, to have your daughter actually have an interest and pick it up, that's got to be pretty exciting. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My daughter just texted me the other day and said, is there a sewing machine around somewhere?
Oh no.
And I'm like, oh, she wants to sew. I'm so excited.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
How old is she?
She will be 19.
Oh, okay.
In just a couple weeks here. So, she is in a graphic design program at Southern Oregon University, and she has suddenly decided she wants to learn how to sew.
All right. Boy, this is a genetic thing, and a woman genetic thing in the family here. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My sister is a quilter.
Oh.
And, yeah. So.
Well, you guys
has her.
You guys have some fun at the holidays then.
Oh yeah. The men just go watch football and we we do our crafty thing.
Yeah, so. Go leave us alone, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So then exactly. Then when does the art and the cross stitch come together to start making designs?
Well, I think probably right in that whole crafting period of my life. I was, of course, getting cross-stitch magazines, and one of my favorites was put out by Leisure Arts for the Love of Cross-Stitch. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, yeah.
But they would run contests, they would give a subject matter or something like that and say, design something around a song and send it in to us. And if you win, you get this, and the pattern would be published. So I designed the stuff, but never got it finished and, had it sitting here. So I had started designing way back in the early 90s when I was doing my toll painting, and, was actually in court. I had incorporated some cross stitch with some toll painting and sold it at my little craft booth. And,
for zero profit.
For zero profit. And, so that's where the design started. I think children got in the way. The kids started arriving, it was sort of like I needed to put all of that stuff on the back burner.
Yeah.
And not that I wasn't cross-stitching. It was actually much easier to cross-stitch and have small children around than it was to paint.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Not a lot less likely to have little fingerprints of paint around if it's not there to begin with. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing as a mother with cross stitch, or actually with any needlework, is you can use that to fill those times when you're waiting to pick up or, at the baseball practice or any number of things. It comes in as a handy little thing. Yeah.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Sitting in the car. I might as well do something.
Yeah. Precisely.
Yep.
And heaven knows I've done a lot of that.
Yeah. So then you have the, all right, this is just a real nice evolution for you into design.
Yes. Yeah. It kind of married those two, the painting, crafting side of things with the graphic design. Mm-hmm. So designing on a grid for needlework is like the, it's right up a graphic designer's alley.
Right.
Because you're already thinking in terms of grids anyway, when right. you're graphic designing, you know, you're thinking about placement and you're thinking about positive and negative space. And really you're just taking all of that and applying it to needle and thread and fabric.
Yeah. Cause that's your ground cloth. It doesn't matter what the actual material is. That's your ground cloth is a grid. Yes. So you're
yes.
not even a difficult transition for you.
No. It was perfect. Probably pretty perfect. And it also made me feel good, you know, like having to put all of that on the back burner for 15, 16 years, feeling like, oh, okay, my college education was worth something. Hmm. You know, I've been able to now apply it.
Yeah.
Not where I expected to, but in a way that is fulfilling and probably better than I hoped for.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so the, as the kids get older, then do you start to haul it out and work on it? Or is it just some point where, all right, now I have enough free time, I can actually devote some, I can do something for me.
Yeah. Actually probably about, so I homeschooled our kids. And probably about 5 years ago,
ooh, tip of the cap for that. Holy smokes. Yeah.
Thanks. I with my oldest, I feel like I deserved every bit of that tip. So, so about 5 years ago, my husband says, so what's next? Because our son had graduated from high school, our middle child daughter, who's now in college, was just starting high school. And we had decided with our youngest that she would attend a small private Christian school here in town. And he said, so what's next? And I had to mull that over. I probably mulled that over for a good year. You know, just as we transitioned right. from full-time, full-on homeschooling to something a lot less intense. And
I would have taken a good year. Yeah.
Because
that homeschooling, oh man, that's hard. It got to be harder on the parents than the kids. That's
some days. I mean, you know, I had this. I literally worked on one project and it's still not done. I had a little bag that I took with me if we were going anywhere in the car, and I would stitch on that little project. And it's still not done, and I've been stitching on it probably for 20 years. And But a lot of my creative energies went into, you know, planning schedules and curriculum and teaching and all of that. So, you know, it took a while to shift gears from homeschooling mom to cross-stitch designing mom.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there was a period where you just got to flush your brain. That's the thing that, you know, people say, because I taught for a few years, and you know, people like, well, teachers, you know, they only have to work 9 months and blah 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 blah. And I say to every one of them, all right, if that's what you think, then you go stand in front of a classroom of 25 or 30 kids 5 days a week for 9 months of the year, and then you come back and talk to me. But until then, I can't hear you, because you have to be a performer, an educator, creative artist, all of it. Yep. Don't even tell me. I don't want to hear about it. Yeah.
Yeah. The job that's helped pay the bills for the cross stitch business is this. I substitute teach. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah. No, I don't listen to anybody. Don't tell me about teachers. Because I always say you can always tell the teacher at a basketball game because he or she is sitting on the top row of the bleachers grading papers because they're on supervision duty that night and the papers have to get graded. And so that's a little look into what their home life is like.
So, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No.
Right.
Don't tell me about teachers.
Yeah, it's not 8 to 3 and 9 months out of the year.
No. It's around the clock for 9 months of the year and then 3 months to regain your sanity and start over.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. So you still substitute teaching. Wow.
Not for the last couple months, but.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But yes, I keep it down to probably just one day a week and it's a good outlet for me.
Yeah.
You know, and it keeps me motivated to come back and do designing too, because, you know, you have those great days when you go in and substitute teach and the kids are great. And then you have those days and you're like, I really don't want to keep doing this.
Yeah. There's your motivation right there. That's the kick in the butt. Yep. Okay.
Yeah. I want to make enough money at this so I don't have to substitute teach. Anyway.
So you start designing. Do you make a conscious decision that I'm going to start designing? Okay.
Yes, I did. I had this little idea for my first design was the little Lou Hoop bird with the knit cap and the earmuffs. And that was my first idea. And I drew it out, got my grid paper out and put it on there and started stitching it just to see how it would go. Because while I had been stitching through the years, I hadn't been keeping up necessarily with what was going on in the cross stitch and needlework industry. Uh-huh. And so I had no idea. I knew there was Etsy. What had happened in the meantime was Etsy. And that opened up all kinds of new opportunities for getting designs out there. So I thought, well, okay, if I'm going to do this, I got to, you know, figure out what it is I'm designing.
Right.
And I just, I went back and revisited some of those designs that I did for the contests. And I have one of those in my Etsy shop. And then.
Okay. So they weren't so bad then, huh?
No, I don't think so. I got the rainbow upside down on one, but other than that, I was able to use a couple of stuff that I had designed years ago.
See, that's pretty neat because I'm always curious about that. You know, as a designer, do you go back to your first designs and go, oh, what was I thinking? Or did you really have something going there? And it sounds like you had something going. That's great.
Yeah, I think I did. So that was kind of nice that I didn't look at it and go, oh, way outdated.
Yeah,
exactly. I looked at it and went, it needed a little tweaking, but I felt like, you know, it's worth the effort.
Yep.
I'm going to take this and go with it. Yeah.
So where does the Lou Hoop part come from? What, help me with that.
So my name's Cindy. And when I was in college, one of my roommates just started calling me Cindy Lou Who. And, you know, kind of based on, you know, we had, you know, my generation, we all grew up watching The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, you know, the cartoon version. Mm-hmm. And so, she, you know, that's where she got it. And then, you know, I had a nickname. You know, we all had nicknames for each other. Mine just happened to be Cindy Lou Who. And when I sat down, I was like, okay, now I'm designing cross stitch again. What am I going to call this business?
Yeah.
And my husband kind of said, well, what about your name? You know, and I'm like, oh, well, I don't know. Cindy Young.
Yeah.
And then I remembered my nickname, Lou Who, and I thought, okay, I think we can do something here. Yep. And I sat down and started writing it out, and the traditional spelling wasn't working for me. So I just went phonetically and came up with the LUHU, and that's kind of the thought process behind the Luhu.
Well, so now you have a unique name. Yeah, that's.
I hope so. Yeah, it certainly generates conversation. I can't tell you how many times at Nashville people ask me, "Where did you get Luhu from?" Right.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
No, that's great. So then you say, all right, I've got something going with my original designs. Did you build off of that, or did you have over the years a whole bunch of other things stored up in your head that just had to spill out?
Yes, all of that.
Okay.
So I did go kind of with some of those older designs to help kind of get things going, and then I started just looking at old sketches and then creating new sketches, and I'm doing, you know, kind of looking also at some of my inspiration artists and seeing, you know, what do I want to draw from here? And, you know, what kind of a aesthetic do I want? And I'm still working on that, but what are the things that I love, you know, about cross stitch, about design, that I want to bring to the table, essentially. And that's kind of the thought process there was. And I just started putting stuff out. I mean, the great thing about Etsy and a PDF download is there's kind of zero risk.
Right.
You know, you can create a design, put it together, and upload it onto Etsy and just see what happens.
Yep.
And I did that for a couple of years. So.
Yeah, that's where you and I are in the same boat in that we got to see from old school graphic arts and paper and all those things all the way through to today where everything's electronic and you have these outlets that living in Northern California, you wouldn't normally have. And you have a way to get yourself in the market without having to move or travel to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, it's like, wow, what happened in the last 20 years? That was amazing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep. Well, and that's just it. If you're smart enough to latch onto it, you can really use it to your advantage. And so many people, that's too much for me. And, I don't want to do that. And no, you latch onto that and ride it because it's there for you. Yeah.
Right. Well, and I think part of that early experience with going to craft shows and when you know, one thing about those is that there becomes sort of this carny kind of carnival like person who they're at every craft show and you're like, when do you have time to even create?
Yeah.
Because you're traveling from craft show to craft show and they all know each other. And, you know, and if you're like I was who, you know, just this kind of a housewifey person who's just trying to make a little extra money on the side, you know, you're not going to be involved in that part of the, the scene. So when Etsy comes along and the internet and everything like that, it's like, whoa, this is great. I don't have to travel.
Right. Yeah. No more craft fairs for me.
Right. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, there's got to be a social element to those things that draws people. That's because there's no money to be made, and there's an incredible amount of time and travel, and it's got to be it's got to be that club thing that develops that makes it worth it. I guess I
wasn't into that, so
not my cup of tea. I guarantee
it wasn't
that.
My cup of tea. No,
I had so much fun. You mentioned about your artist that you like. And I actually, in getting ready for this, spent some time looking them up because I remembered Richard Scarry.
Yes.
From reading books to our kids.
Yes.
And so that name, I knew immediately what kind of artwork that was, even though I went back and looked at it. But the others, and Charlie Harper, I know from Painted Needlepoint canvases.
Right.
So that one I knew. But the other two were Mary Blair and Joan Anglin?
Joan Welsh England. Yeah. Yeah.
Boy, those were those were fun.
Right. Well, and Mary Blair was kind of like the you see her work in Disney, but nobody knows who she is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she did a lot of development in Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty, and of course, probably for me, her biggest thing that she did for Disney was It's a Small World. And for me as a child, her art, when I realized who she was and I went, oh, well, that was all my favorite artwork as a kid. You know, her color combinations, her palettes, her shapes, mm-hmm. and the way she laid things out. So you get this sense of flatness, but three dimensionality at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, my favorite ride at Disneyland to this day, and my family kind of, they'll go on it with me once, but my husband will go with me twice. And then after that, I have to go by myself, is It's a Small World. And I don't go for the song because admittedly.
Oh, that song. Do not get that song in my head. No, no, not that. No.
It'll drive you nuts, but I couldn't.
It never
look.
Goes away.
No, I know. It's what I call one of those worm songs. It worms its way into your head. But I could just look at the artwork forever, probably.
Uh-huh.
I love it. And particularly her original designs. They've kind of brought in, you know, characters from different Disney movies in her sort of design style into the ride, but I like the old, like her original stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, it's just, it's incredibly inspiring for me.
And, so of the four, of the four, she's the one that's at the core for you then.
Yeah, she really is.
Yeah.
I think Charlie Harper is kind of in that same kind of category. It's like, this looks really simple, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, it's more intricate. And then I think with Richard Scarry and Joan Welsh England, they impart a sort of feeling and coziness that I want to bring into my work.
Yeah.
You know, so between the four of them, but they're all, you know, artists that before I knew who they were, I enjoyed their work.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
It was just a style that connected with you.
Right. Right. And it is sort of a mid-century modernist illustration style, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it kind of makes sense. I'm a mid-century kid, so.
Well, but there's a timeless element to it, too.
Yes.
I mean, like Richard Scarry's stuff works today as well as it did 30 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't get dated. No, that's what Charlie Harper stuff. I mean, people today still latch onto his stuff for needlework all the time.
Right. Yeah. And there's because I go to quilt shows with my sister, there's somebody who's making quilt patterns.
Oh.
Based on his work as well and his wife's work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, and yeah, there's something, you're right. There's something timeless about it.
Yeah.
That I think carries through.
Yeah. It was an interesting set of four. And, because normally I would not, have taken the time, but, because I knew Richard Scarry just from raising kids, it's pretty hard not to.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you're a real blockhead if you miss that.
Yeah, no kidding.
But then it was, all right, now I gotta go on this little journey and see who these others are and see what they do. And, you owe me a couple hours of my life, but,
oh, sorry.
No, but it was fun. It was fun because you could see, and then I went and looked at your work and I could see the influences, but then with your own twist. And it was fun for me to piece it together.
Well, good.
Yeah.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did.
Good.
You still owe me 2 hours, but I enjoyed it.
Tell you what, next Nashville, I'll buy you a drink, okay?
Okay, okay, you're on. So then you take that, and then talk about your colors. Talk about how you handle colors. Is that also influenced from that, or do you just have your own kind of little world of color palettes?
You know, I saw that you gave me that list to kind of think about, and I thought, okay, how do I, because color is extremely important to me. I've thought about what would happen if I couldn't see color. I hear about colorblind people and I'm like, oh, I feel so sorry for you. Because I think from a young age, my earliest memories probably involve color and bright colors and, you know, those sort of translucent pinks and blues and greens and that kind of make my heart sing. And so when I sit down, I sometimes think, okay, I want to do something more delicate, more muted, and I can't. It's like my pencil won't go there.
Yeah.
To that. I mean, not that you don't use shades of color, but I want to apply the color. I want the color to be inspiring,
mm-hmm.
and to render a feeling in the person who's looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is why sometimes I wish I could make myself go more pastel because, you know, maybe I want to, you know, give a more peaceful feeling. You know, I kind of think of the impressionist painters like Monet and Renoir who, you know, use actually very muted colors, but vibrant at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think about Monet's water lilies, and I was blessed to be able to see a portion of the panels of the Monet water lilies at the Museum of Modern Art in New York one time and sit. It's a room. You sit in a room with these paintings and, you know, your first impression is pastels and muted, but it's not, it's a vibrant color and you're surrounded by it. And I think for me, when I'm designing, I need to really use that,
mm-hmm.
and let that out of my pencil or my paintbrush or my needle. And so even when I go and just pick out threads at random, I go for the brights. I go for the bright pastels and the bright, you know, not neon. I'm not really into neon.
Yeah.
But, you know, more vibrant colors. And so I think that informs my color palette a lot. And I also, you know, kind of being a new housewife in the early 80s when mauve and country blue were in, you know,
yeah.
and geese, you know, I try to avoid stuff like that. I want something that I don't want a grayed down color.
Right.
Unless it's going to help a brighter color shine.
Yeah. And see, and I see that in your designs. Yeah. You have that one or two bright colors and then you support it with a more muted stuff and consistently. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also think it's really important to use black or a dark color when I'm designing to anchor the design.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of a principle in interior design is that you want something black in the room so that your room doesn't feel like it's floating away. And I think that principle kind of carries through in other forms of artwork as well. You want that to, you know, artwork to be balanced, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where having a dark color versus some really bright colors comes in.
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of a overriding principle everywhere. I know in my photography efforts, you know, that when you're, yes, when you're processing images, where's mm-hmm. the black? Find the dead black and make sure it stays black.
Yeah.
Don't let it gray out, because you, then you, yeah, you lose your depth.
Right.
And, yep.
Right.
And right. Find your white, but don't blow it out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's why, I think that's why it's hard to photograph needlework sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, so. Yeah.
Well, and that's, you know, that's that principle you learn in photography, because back in the day when you learned photography, the instruction from any veteran was go shoot black and white, develop it and print it.
Yeah.
If you can come up with a good black and white image consistently, then you have it.
Right.
Because if you try color, your mind will compensate all day long with color. But
right.
when it's not there and your image is alive, then you have it. You found it. And then you build off of that. Then you can add color and do it in intelligently and make it work, but you still have right. those principles that are underlying. Yes.
Yeah. So when I was in school, I had to take a color class, and you learn the color wheel, and then you learn about hue and you learn about value. And yeah. interestingly enough, we started out with a value, which is from blackest black to whitest white.
Mm-hmm.
And then you, like you were saying, then you apply the color.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it creates the boundary, and
right.
and you have the depth, and then you, now what's going to go in the middle here that's going to make it come, make it work? Yes.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
So I think all of that, what we've been talking about, really informs my design. Mm-hmm. And that color class that I just mentioned was probably the most important class for me when I was in school. And I'm kind of sad my daughter doesn't have to take one because I feel like that helps you grasp when you're laying something out in a design, that helps you understand the difference between white space and dark space, negative yeah. space and positive space.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can apply your color to help balance things out. And I think there are people who have an innate ability to do that. And I think a lot of artists do before they get training.
Mm-hmm.
But when you understand it, when I feel like because I've had the training, it's given me a little bit of, it just helps me, you know, do better.
Yeah.
I hope. I hope I do better.
Well, you have a, you know why it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's the part yeah. is you can have an intuitive understanding, but then when you have the why, I think that gives you a set of tools that now you can work with it. And
yeah.
Yeah. It puts that extra dimension on it. Yes.
Right. Or if you're having trouble with something and you can't figure out what it was, you have those tools to say, this is why it's not working.
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
or this is why it is working,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. Can help you get out of a spot that's just not, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's not, yeah, where, you know, a hump spot. And that's why a lot of times, like, I have to put something down and walk away from it for a while,
mm-hmm.
sometimes a day, a week, a month, you know, so the design process can be as immediate as 24 hours, or it can take me months to work through a design.
Yeah.
You know,
that's interesting how that is the case in just about everything, is that. Yeah, yeah. Some things are pretty automatic, and all right, that's it. I got it. But
yeah,
so
yeah.
many of them, all right, I think I have it, but I'm too close to it. I have to walk away. I have to come back with fresh eyes.
And, right.
Yeah. And so you just set it aside and forget about it. And
right.
Yeah. Then you come back and you go, all right, all but this right over here. This needs it. This needs a something. Yeah.
Right. And sometimes that's hard because you get wrapped up in one little element of the design and you love it.
Mm-hmm.
But it may not actually be.
It needs
helping.
To go away.
Yeah, it needs to go away. You know, it's like it doesn't belong in this design. You love it, but maybe it belongs in something else.
Yep.
you know. So hold on to it, but it can't go here.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and reaching that conclusion can be really tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, another thing that happens in design school is you have, or I had to go through a, you know, usually you have a critique. You'll work on a, you'll be working on an assignment or a project, and then you have to kind of show your progress to the class, and they're allowed to critique it. And that can be brutal, absolutely brutal, but it can also be very constructive and help you leap some hurdles in the design process, because somebody else is going to look at it with totally different eyes than you're looking at it. And they aren't nearly as close to it emotionally either.
Right.
So,
yeah. In many cases, simply don't care. So, yeah.
Right. Which is, I really don't care if you get an A on this project or not.
But that's done correctly, that's a positive. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
I don't care. Absolutely. And so therefore this is what I see and it's not working. Yeah.
Right. Right. Right.
Or brilliantly done, you know? Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's really nice to get a brilliantly done in a design review. So.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. Yep. So take me through the process here before we run out of time. Constant sketches, stitch before you chart before you stitch. What is your process?
Oh, absolutely. Chart before I stitch. Okay. And yeah, I usually have, I try to always have some kind of sketchbook with me, but a lot of times I don't. So for one reason or another. So a lot of times it's on the back of receipts that get saved, church bulletins, you know, in my Bible sometimes,
oh, geez.
you know, stuff like that, that, I go back to. I do have a sketchbook that I've kept over the years and done work in. And so I have gone back to really old stuff and pulled from it. And, you know, because if it's just an idea, you know, if I want to do something with a bunny, well, I sketched a bunny way back when. Uh-huh. Let me go look at that. And then you pull it out and you go, okay, what can I do with this bunny? And you start working with it and suddenly it fleshes out into a design. So, you know, I take it from a very rudimentary sketch into more of a drawing. And sometimes I can get what I want pretty quickly. And then I take my, I still work old school, probably because that's the way I was trained. I get my vellum graph paper out and I lay it on top of my drawing. And I'm, and it's part of the process for me.
Yeah.
It's part of the thinking process for me. And so then I start, I'm just going around the outline, sort of pixelizing it because, I don't know if you noticed, I use a lot of curves in my work.
Yes.
And not a lot of straight lines, which can be very difficult when you're pixelizing it.
Right.
And so I get that figured out. And then I start figuring out where the color goes. And I usually am working, you know, I have a color drawing. And so about then is when I pull my threads and start figuring out what thread is it that I'm visualizing with this color that I've used on the paper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, what translates, and do I want it to be a flat, just flat dyed color, you know, like a DMC, or do I want it to have a little more depth like you would if you were coloring with a crayon?
Mm-hmm.
And so then I go to an over dyed floss or something like that. And I will use, you know, and then I put together my thread palette at that point and start figuring out where everything goes. And then I go to the computer and put it all in the computer.
Yeah.
And somewhere in there, I've also figured out what cloth I want to use. I typically go toward, like, I love raw cashel linen. Mm-hmm. And I like even weaves, you know, so usually a Lugana or a Monaco, something mm-hmm. like that. And sometimes color fabric and sometimes more of a neutral.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's just it. These days, there's all those options, so you can really play back and forth until you get the combination that really sings to you. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, so. I think I can say this because I'm pretty sure our pastor demographic is quite small, but church is a great place for ideas, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, end this sermon. I got to go home. I got an idea.
Right. You know, or I think we were not long ago that the pastor was teaching on Peter walking on the water, and I drew this little boat with the wind, and I'm like, oh, I think I need to go work on this. Oh, yeah. What was he saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
My husband's elbowing me in the ribs, you know, and yeah.
Yep.
So,
yeah, the mind opens up at times in the church. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a good place. A lot of times you sit and you're a lot more reflective. So yes. There's an opportunity to actually let things work out a little bit.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nope. Happened to me a lot. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And obviously to me.
Yep. Well, it's, and it isn't just church. I mean, it's that kind of environment where you get to put your mind in neutral and then, there's little inspirations that then start triggering things. And
yeah. Actually, substitute teaching a lot of times can be the same thing depending on the grade level I'm in. Oh. You know, I always bring a sketchbook. Uh-huh. When I'm subbing, because I'll walk into a classroom and I'll see a piece of student art and I'll be inspired by that to do something. Or maybe I'm reading a story to the kids that inspires me or something like that. And getting a quick sketch or at least writing down a word is really important, you know.
Yep.
So, obviously at the younger grades, not as big an opportunity.
No, I'm sure grades, not.
But
keep things moving.
Yes. Do not let them get distracted.
No, you'll never get them back.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. So,
Cindy,
anyway.
Yeah. I've enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
A lot of fun. Love your designs too. Yep.
Well, thank you very much.
Good
thank
stuff.
You.
All right. Well, we got to stop. I got more questions, darn. So you know we'll have to have you back again. But
I would love that.
Yeah,
I would love that.
Got to stop. So, all right. Okay. Thanks to Susan at Fire Poppies for sponsoring, and Cindy, thanks. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.